Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast.
Today, I'm once again pleased and proud to have Mads Terkelsen. He's the lead, am I getting it right, the lead designer?
Yeah, that's what I am.
Lead designer of C# for Microsoft, which is it's very exciting. Anyway, how are you, Mads?
I'm doing pretty good. The sun is shining here in Seattle, and you know, it's a new year, and all in all, yeah, just a tad more than just hanging in there, I would say.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Staying safe, I hope.
Oh yeah.
Let me start us off by asking you a question that I've been wanting to ask someone for quite a while, which is, I think at this point, a lot of us know the how of what's new in C# 8 and 9. But for me, a big question is when. Mm-hmm. What kinds of problems am I look at and then say, oh, I should be using pattern matching here. I should be using a switch, not a switch statement, but rather a switch expression. Here's a great opportunity to use records. And that, I think, is the really hard part, is to integrate that into your approach to programming.
Right. Now, and that is a really key question, because the when for you as a user of C# is the why for us as designers, you know? And you may ask yourself, like, why do we keep adding these features? What is motivating it? And to a large extent, I mean, you can go all the way back to our published language strategy that you can find. It's a post that I did almost 4 years ago on the .NET blog now. Which is that we are determined that with C# we want to track, you know, changes in the developer landscape, new domains, new techniques that emerge from, you know, just technology evolving around us and scenarios evolving and making those a good experience in C# as well. So when you bring up pattern matching and you bring up records, they very much fall into that category of, well, now's a really good time to introduce those because the scenarios where they are useful are becoming more and more abundant. And so if we start with pattern matching, for instance, it is more and more the case that you are working on data that is in a way that's separate from the functionality, right? So the classic object-oriented paradigm that C# was built around was that you would write classes that encapsulated some state with some functionality, and they would always travel together. And that's great for modeling many things. It continues to be. But when it comes to a modern cloud-based world, one where you share data and use it for many different things and so on, more and more often it's the case that you have some data that you get over the wire from a database or some centralized source maybe, and you want to do something specific with it. And this data may be organized in hierarchies and whatnot, but it doesn't travel with its own functionality. It's not built in what you want to do with it. That's up to you as the recipient of the data. That means you need to separate what you would normally in the old days do with a virtual method, you know, that you overwrite for each quote unquote shape of the data, you know, each derived class. That kind of specialized behavior for each shape, you now have to specify that separate from the data itself, which somebody else already specified and gave to you.
And when you say now, you mean with the latest C#?
Yes, or with sort of C#, since C# 7, we've embraced pattern matching in some form, and we've refined it through every release since then, certainly every major release. And that is to better and better enable this scenario where you don't get to write your functionality as a virtual method. You get some data and it already has a shape and there's already a hierarchy of classes representing it maybe. And you have to say, well, if it's a manager, I have to do this. If it's a student, I have to do this. You know, you have to have this conditional behavior on the shape and sometimes on the data itself that's involved. And pattern matching gives you a really natural facility for writing that code in a way that's easy to read and very neatly structured and highly checked by the compiler. Where if you try to do all that with if statements and type checks and so on, it will become a mess and it will be error prone and the compiler wouldn't help you get it right. Does that give you like a good high level motivation?
It does. Yes, very much so. But let me hone in and say I'm working on a project and I'm going to slap my head and say, pattern matching is going to solve this problem. And I'm going to want to recognize when that occurs. And so Can you give me a couple scenarios from the perspective of the programmer, the user of C Sharp, on when that's going to happen? How do I recognize that situation?
I mean, one, if you're like a very a classically trained C Sharp programmer, one way to say it is, I wish I could go into the source code of this data representation and add this virtual method. You know, yes. That'd be one. And another way of thinking of it is, somebody else designed these data structures. I would like to write conditional behavior over them. Like, I receive this data over the wire. I want to treat it in different ways depending on what exactly it is. Those are the scenarios where your mind should go, ah, pattern matching. You know, pattern matching is really good for taking data that, you know, shares a base type, and you get it at some base representation. And now you want to specialize your behavior depending on what's inside, depending on what derived class it's of, depending on what data is inside, depending on whether something is a Boolean is true or false inside, and all those kinds of things. And you want to separate out your treatment of it in different cases, like literally think of the word cases. Do I want to do case-specific handling of this? And if so, then you want to use pattern matching. And so I strongly suggest that you will. Like, pattern matching is probably your best match. This is the kind of scenario it's built for. And then, do you want to use pattern match? You probably want to use pattern matching in a switch. And should that then be a switch statement or a switch expression? Well, that depends, again, on your, that depends on your scenario. Are you going to take certain actions based on the shape, or are you going to build a certain result? If you're, if it's the latter, then something that you would typically do in a single expression, like a new expression or a call to a factory method, or you're extracting some data and returning it. In those cases, those are good examples of where you'd use switch expressions, right? So you have a switch expression produces a result, and the result is computed depending on which case gets picked inside of the switch expression.
Yes, yes, that's actually very helpful. I mean, that's, actually, that's very helpful.
Good, yeah, that's it. That's a next level drill down on it. Like, yes, I want to use pattern matching. How do I want to use it? Well, that depends on, are you more sort of action oriented? Are you having side effects and mutating stuff and or printing stuff out and pulling levers and. Or are you actually just producing some result in response to the shape of data you're observing? And if it's the latter, then that's what switch expressions are for. And they are, I mean, everything you can do with a switch expression, you can also do with a switch statement. But it just, it's a less laborious, more in-place way of doing it. Which also means that sometimes if you know, your switch expression may grow up to where it starts being unwieldy to do things in there, like in place in the middle of an expression. And that's where you might consider graduating, quote unquote, to a switch statement instead, which are perfectly adequate for this kind of purpose. Like, switch statements used to be very clunky, and they still have a little bit sort of a 20th century feel to them. But with pattern matching in switch statements, you know, they're a lot more advanced, and they're a great way of doing things.
Okay, now, I'm sorry, maybe I got lost, but you just said that you would start with switch expressions, and then when it got complicated, you'd go to switch statements, and I would have thought it was the other way around.
Actually, the switch expression is the simpler form. It's a newer form, but it's also the simpler form. So it's like, okay, you can get, if your objective is to produce data as a result of the switch, then switch expression is probably what you want, but sometimes, you know, if you need to do a lot of, if producing that data is very complicated and you can't really sort of stay in expression land, if you will, like you want to have multiple statements to produce the results, you can't really do that in a switch expression. You can only have expressions inside. So that's where, you know, yeah, you might start reaching for some like tricks. If it's rare, you might reach for a trick like having a local function that you call as an expression, and then the local function has those statements inside. But if it becomes more and more, if it becomes harder and harder to read the switch expression, the general form is the switch statement. That's the one, that's a fallback form that can do everything.
Gotcha. Okay, let me ask you to do a similar thing with records. Records are new in 9, if I have that right.
Yes.
And maybe we could talk a little bit about when you would recognize a situation that says, oh, I need a record here. I need to use records here.
Yes. So So C sharp, as it used to be up until C sharp 9, there were sort of two paths you could go down with your data types. You could either go the class-based approach or the value type approach, a struct approach, right? So if you think about structs in C sharp, they're value-based, which means that a struct doesn't have a strong identity. The state it has is, it can be encapsulated, but if you compare two structs for equality, for instance, that equality is based on what's inside, not based on the quote unquote object reference or identity, which they don't have, right? So structs are very value based. That's why they call value types. and also when you assign them, you get a copy, right? So they're not assigned by reference either. They're assigned by copy. Now, on the other hand, there's a lot of things you can't do with structs. You can't have hierarchies of them, for instance. There's no inheritance hierarchy mechanism. You don't have polymorphism where you have a reference to a base struct, but it actually points to a derived struct or something like that. So you can't really do advanced modeling with data modeling. And so records are there to bridge the gap between classes and structs in a way where you want advanced data modeling, but you want to think of the data, as values, not as, you know, objects with identity and their own evolving state. So you want to use all the bells and whistles of class-based modeling, but you want the objects, the values of those classes, to have value behavior by default. And what that means is that when you compare two of them for equality, for instance, they will be compared based on what's inside, based on their fields, their actual state, just like structs, instead of just, are they the same object, which is the default reference equality that you get with classes normally. So a record is a class with value equality. And then also, records are also better primed for working with immutable data. So a record will typically be immutable. We don't enforce that, but records are really good for working with immutable data. So that's something that's also becoming more and more common, that people model things with immutable representations. It gives you a way of separating sort of the snapshot state that something has at a given time from the evolution over time of state, right? So you can have multiple values representing the state of the same logical object at different points in time. So say that you have a UI, for instance, that, you know, the UI is clearly mutable, right? It mutates all the time. It evolves over time. But it's really nice to be able to represent what it looked like at a given time. And so some UI frameworks do this by, instead of mutating the representation of the UI itself, they build a new one every time it updates. They copy the old one and make changes. It's sort of a copy modify approach, if you will, where each frame, the representation of each version of it, each point in time, each snapshot is fixed. And then whenever you want to make a change, you make a new one. And that's really good. It allows you to do divs and rollback and all kinds of stuff. And it makes threading much easier. So that's also something you often want to do with wire data or things that you interact with in the cloud. So that operation of saying, okay, I want to represent the next state of this thing. I want to represent the state of Mads Torgersen after he got married instead of before he got married. You know, something changed. Instead of mutating the original object and destroying the record of what I looked like before I was married, what my data looked like, I want to create a new record of Mads Torgersen as a married person. That's just like the old one, except one or two things changed in the data. And records support that just like except thing with a new kind of expression that's called a with expression. So I can say Mads, I have a reference to the old Mads object, I can say Mads with, and then an object initializer that says last name equals and changes my last name, or, you know, whatever else data needs to change. And that way, there's a language-built-in way of getting a copy of me that's ever so slightly modified to represent the new state. That was a long explanation, but hopefully...
No, that was a great explanation. I'll know.
Hopefully you're
sitting here wondering if I owe you congratulations on getting married.
No, it's a long time ago. yeah, that record was updated long before C# was in existence.
So, can I mix and match records with classes in a given program? Would that make sense to do that?
Yes. You can't, currently in C# 9, you can't cross-inherit between them. Like, records really are classes, and they can do everything classes can do, except they can't inherit from classes, and classes can't inherit from them. So they're separate kind of realms, if you will. You start a hierarchy, you have to stick to whether it's a class hierarchy or a record hierarchy. But in all other respects, they can coexist, they can reference each other, they're very similar. They have similar capabilities, other than the records having these value-based behaviors, the equality, the support for with expressions. They also have a value-based toString, where they will actually, render a textual representation of their contents rather than just give you some obscure object reference by default.
No, say a little bit more about that last sentence.
Yeah, they have a toString that will actually loop through all their fields and produce a string that contains a toString of all their data. So kind of like, have you ever tried to toString an anonymous type in C#? They have a toString that, sometimes when you write out link queries or something, you use anonymous types and they just render themselves nicely as strings. And we decided that records should have that same capability. You can override it if you want. It's a tiny bit dangerous because in principle, when you write out, when you recursively call toString, you could end up chasing a cycle. You get a very big toString, or you can end up actually chasing a cycle in the object graph and your toString blows the stack. That's going to happen very rarely because the same goes for equality. Actually, if you have value-based equality, you're going to recursively call equals on the things that are inside. And if they also have value-based equals, and there's a cycle, you would end up running all the way around. But the thing is, you are overwhelmingly more likely to use records. Records are intended to be used for immutability. And you can't easily create cycles in an immutable object graph. So that's sort of like the saving grace here. And, if you have that, if you end up making something so complicated that you end up actually having problems with that, then you probably made it too complicated, Right. Records are more for like simple data representation and where these defaults are the right thing. And if you don't like the defaults of the, just like you can overwrite the default behavior of a class, like you can overwrite toString, you can overwrite equals, you can also overwrite the default behavior of a record. So if you like most of it, but you don't like how it toStrings, or you want to tinker with how it does equals or whatever, you can go in and override it. It's just that it has different defaults.
So records work with link in this exact same way as classes do.
Yes.
Is that an accurate statement?
They work exactly like classes do in every respect, except that they have value-based defaults for certain behaviors and they can't currently cross inherit with classes.
Yes, I heard the currently in that.
There's an ambition. There are a few bits of special magic in records right now that ideally a record would be something that you could totally explain what a record declaration means in terms of rewriting it into a class declaration, right? It would just be sort of a advanced syntactic sugar over classes. But we are not quite there yet. We need a few more, at least one or two more language features in the language before we could do that. They have special magic that only the compiler knows about today, like how they implement the with functionality. And so for that reason, the cross inheritance is murky, and we expect to support it one day, but we're not quite there yet.
So what's the current cadence? When should we look for C# 10?
Yeah, see, so that's a big discussion we've been having actually over the last several years now. Since we announced a couple of years ago that we would take .NET, formerly .NET Core, to a yearly cadence. We shipped .NET 5 as the first quote-unquote unified .NET last November, and .NET 6 is there next November. And, you know, every year there will be a new major version of .NET, and every other year on the even versions, there will be LTS versions, a long-term support version. And so we had to think about, well, given that for the underlying platform, what should we do with C#? Are we still better off with like more rare C# versions, major versions that really, you know, pack a lot of punch? Or should we snap to the same scheme as .NET in general and say, well, with every .NET release, there's a C# release, which is more like what Java is doing, for instance. They have a new language release with every release of the platform, for instance. And that we ended up on the latter saying, yeah, we are going to have our plan is to have a C# release with every .NET release. That is once a year. And then in order to do that, we have to start thinking a little differently about it. We have to adopt sort of more like a train model for C# features, where we say that, well, the feature catches the release train that, you know, is the next one that leaves when the feature is done, rather than thinking of each language version as its own project, you know, like what goes into this, start out building it, testing it, tooling it, and then ship this great big package of a language version and start over. We have to do much more of a, well, we just work on language features, and when they're ready, we ship them. And so that's a shift that we're in the middle of as an implementation team right now. But and it may, you know, take a little while for people to get used to on the consuming end. But I think it's going to settle us into a nice cadence where, you know, we are in the same cadence as .NET. People get language features as soon, or, you know, within a year of them being fully finished. But it also has some other advantages that we've gradually begun to appreciate more and more. So I talked about pattern matching before, and that's a feature that you've seen. It was introduced in C# 7.0, and then pretty much with every single release since then, it's evolved some. And we find that we really like this mode of language design where a feature, you know, a big language feature takes a few versions to grow out to its full potential. Like we start with something that we're certain is good, and then we see the feedback and how it's used, and then we might have thought ahead to some directions we want to take it, but then we can, instead of having tried to plan it all out ahead of time and probably gotten things wrong, we can sort of see, well, what's the best, most valuable next step? And does it look like we anticipated, or we need to adjust some things? Then we do the next thing. C# 8 had some next things for pattern matching.
Yes, and your approaching it that way also helps with cognitive overload for those of us who are trying to keep up.
I think it does and it doesn't. in the long term, I think it does. It lets you gradually learn a feature as we gradually build it, I guess is what you're getting at. But it also means that a C# release can look like some small features that are fully shipped and well-rounded in one release, plus, you know, a delta on some big features. Maybe it's the first step, like records in C# 9, or maybe it's a third big step, like pattern matching in C# 9. And you're always sort of getting a new slice of it. And that might also be a little confusing. If you think about it per release, that might be a little confusing. What's in this release? Well, there's a third installment of this and a second installment of that. And then there's this set of little features. So in some ways, it's more confusing, and in some ways, less.
Well, just speaking personally, in terms of pattern matching, I found that the stepwise introduction allowed me to first grok what it was and then add more complexity and more places that I could use it. So for me, it worked well to have that kind of rollout.
Great. Yeah. And that's what we hear a lot. And it better. So we're sort of like, in a way, we're coupling the learning of the language team to the learning of the language user community more strongly this way, right? We have a shared feedback loop together where we learn about the feature we just made so that we can make the next iteration of it as you, as the community, learn the scenarios where this works well for you and take it into places where we hadn't anticipated, or use it in ways that we haven't anticipated, or tell us about shortcomings that we hadn't thought would be shortcomings, that kind of thing. So it's just a really beneficial sort of feedback loop, yeah, is the best word I think I can think of for between the language evolution and the language use. That is tremendously useful for us as we get better at exploiting it, if you will.
And if members of the community want to give you that kind of feedback, what's the best way to do it?
So we have
your cell number, or how does that work?
So that has been another learning experience for us. How do we scale to much more and much more detailed user feedback from many more users, which is what we want? And the open source home of C#, GitHub.com/C#lang is where that is, where that's at. That is where we do our design work. That is where the notes from all the language design meetings live. That's where the discussions happen. Community members propose features. We propose features. That's where things get, and that's where the discussions are. That's the most scalable way that we have found to involve everyone in the same place. It can be a little bit daunting as a drive-by community member who just wants to go in and engage in a few things. Can be a bit overwhelming. It's not a super curated experience, right? But that is where that happens.
Let me ask you what is potentially I hope not a rude question. There has been a thread that I've been following about whether C# is getting too big for its own good. Have you seen that? And what's your feeling about what people are saying?
I've seen that. And I've seen a particular thread that you're referencing. And also, the same topic has been brought up many times. I remember back when the first C# version I really participated on when I was new at Microsoft 15 years ago was C#3 with the Link and Lambdas and all that. And believe it or not, that same discussion was there at the time as well. And it's not, that's not to, to in any way belittle the discussion, because it is a very relevant one. It's the core question. It's a core question that we have to ask ourselves when we're the stewards of a programming language. Like, are we doing too much? Are we doing too little? Are we doing the right things? Like, we have to keep asking ourselves that. And we have to have some sort of a consistent philosophy for it. And for C#, the philosophy that we settled on from early on, it wasn't super expressed at the time, but even when I joined, there was a clear just kind of vibe around C# that we are going to evolve this one fairly aggressively. Like, there's essentially, as we talked about before, the programming language landscape changes in many ways. Sometimes it's that the tasks you need to do as a programmer changes. Like, since I joined, the cloud became a thing, it wasn't a thing 15 years ago. Whoa, well, all of a sudden, well, not all of a sudden, but fairly suddenly, the things you have to do are different. You can either adapt to those things as best you can. And that also goes for, I should mention another important dimension is that the state of the art of programming languages also evolves. Like, the things that we even realize that we could do, that also evolves all the time. Like, other languages come up with something great, and we're like, ha, we should have that too. And then we plagiarize it to some degree, right? And sometimes we're the plagiarizers, and sometimes we're the plagiarized, or the borrowed from, or the inspiration. And that, luckily, that goes all ways, and we all in the programming language community benefit from that. Like, the number of things that in C# that have been inspired by Scala or Python or, other languages out there that do something, wow, that is, huh, we should, we could do something similar. Let's think about what that would look like in C#. So there's just this whole evolution that's just happening. Either we try to follow that, and we try to say, hey, we want to be great compared to other languages. We want to be a good choice for you for your next project, for a lot of different kinds of projects too, right? We're very general purpose. In order to be that, we just need to evolve. Like, there's no question about it. For the sake of our long-term survival, our long-term attractiveness as a language, we just need to keep evolving. There's just no getting around it. And at the same time, the more we do that, the more features we add, and we can't ever take any out, right? Because I'm sure that Jesse is using some feature that, from C# 2 that nobody else uses, but we're going to break his code if we take it out. The language just grows more and more. And that leads to another problem, which is the problem that is being pointed out in these in these threads, which is, hey, this growth is a little daunting. We can't follow along as educators, as programmers, and so on. This is hard to, it's hard to keep up in real time sometimes, especially when as when there are new concepts introduced that are mind-boggling at first and so on. And we realize that that is a, that is also a negative, right, of rapid evolution, even as we're trying to keep up with, well, the other languages can do this. They have pattern matching and people really like it, you know. We would really benefit from having it too. At the same time, well, now there's pattern matching. And you have to go like, well, as a developer, you have to go like, well, how do I make sense of this? As an educator, you have, or author or whatever, you have to make, how do I explain this now? How do I rationalize, at, you know, the question you asked me in the beginning, how do, when should I use this versus something else? And so we're putting a lot of pressure on the whole system with it.
Yeah.
And you kind of just have to, I don't think there's not an out, there's not an easy out to this problem. It's a conundrum. It's a scale. And you have to just orient yourself on that scale deliberately instead of accidentally. And we've done that. We said, if we think it's going to be good for the long term for the language, we're going to do it. Even if that, you know, puts pressure on the system right now. And that's as opposed to becoming a legacy language that people will only pick up when they have a, you know, code already in it that they need to maintain. That's either way, you have some downsides.
Yes, that was, thank you. That was a very balanced explanation. I'm going to make the docs people crazy by asking this, but I find that the documentation has gotten much, much better than it used to be. But there's a very strong emphasis on jumping into the here's how you do it. And maybe I'm missing it. It's entirely possible that this is my fault, that it doesn't feel as strong an explanation of under these cases, under these scenarios, think of using this technique, which for me would be very, very helpful.
I suggest, I think, you know, everyone needs different things from docs. I always, I often consider myself lucky that I didn't end up, I consider myself good at explaining things, but explaining things to everyone all the time is essentially their job. And I don't envy that.
Very hard.
So I think, you know, that occasionally the philosophy of what docs should emphasize changes a little, depending on, you know, who's considered, how the main target is thought of.
Yes. I was just doing a little special pleading there. No reason to take it seriously.
No, I mean, that is a problem too, which is that how do you provide the right documentation for everyone or close enough? That's always a challenge. And one thing that is, that I think, just like with the language design itself, there's really like documentation design here. And I think the biggest thing that has happened there isn't just that the documentation got better. It is that the documentation is open source too. And there's a community around that too, with lots and lots of contributions that aren't employed by Microsoft, from people that aren't employed by Microsoft, and lots of discussion of these things. And I think that is part of why it's gotten better, is that there's this feedback loop for the documentation too that didn't used to be there. Used to, again, be people who sat down and said, I wonder what would work. I have this crazy idea. What if we make it all about, you know, what if we make it all like very specific examples instead of explaining the general features? And then, you know, somebody would go off and spend a lot of time doing that until they find out, well, they don't actually like that, do they? We just wasted all this time. You know, now there's a feedback loop and documentation can incrementally get better all the time based on. So
yes,
that will be my answer. And that will be my answer to you. Now that you know why, if when to use these features, or your listeners out there, go and see if you can put together a pull request and take it through, and maybe, you know, you're the one who fixes the problem or helps fix the problem.
Great way to put it back on me. Thank you very much.
Quiet there for a second.
Thinking about that, you know, be this careful what you ask for.
This is the whole secret of open source.
That's right. Yeah, I heard very early on in open source, someone said, never say someone should, say I will. And that usually shuts me right up. So before I let you go, where can people go to see your vision of what's coming?
That's a good question. So I think that most of, so you mean like a video or something?
Or papers or some vision statement? I don't know if you have anything like that, but there's a lot of curiosity about how Microsoft and you in particular see the language evolving over the next, say, 5 years.
Yeah, I don't think that I have anything that gives sort of a grand vision like that. Again, I mean, for the general philosophy of it, I encourage visiting that blog post from 4 years ago, the .NET language strategy. That sort of, that gives a generic thinking on how we approach the problem. The specific language vision for the coming years, I don't think I have anything I can point to there. We don't have like a five-year plan. I realize that a bunch of like talks I've given and so on recently have been very focused on C# 9, which is now out, you know, and so we're in the early stages of putting C# 10 on the road, and we don't have like a great overview of what it all is. We don't even know for sure all the features that are going to be in there, what they're going to look like. But I think, so one, let me give you a few, I can't give you a pointer to where to go and find it other than in the, you know, scattered all over the C# lang repo. But I think that you're going to continue to see some relatively ambitious evolution of the type system as well. I think that one of the things that has changed even since we wrote the language strategy is that we're much more amenable to implementing language features in the runtime, which means that they can reach deeper and they can more deeply tinker with, you know, the underlying type system of .NET. And there are some things that we're eager to do there that can help with expressiveness. One of the things that I just discussed with a couple of people today is this idea we've had around for over a decade of allowing interfaces to specify static members. That's, and what that would allow in terms of scenarios is that one kind of static member that an interface could specify as a contract would be operators. And now you could have a much better ability to abstract over math. You know, try writing a generic algorithm that uses operators in C# today. It's impossible. It's very painful to do any kind of abstracted math, any kind of algorithm that involves the least bit of numerics. C# just isn't good at that because we don't have the right abstraction mechanism. And so that's one thing that I think now we can actually do what was proposed 10 years ago. We couldn't do it then. Now we can do it. So that's a kind of thing you might, that's a thing and a kind of thing that you might see where we reach a little more deeply and say, hey, maybe there's a fundamental new expressiveness that we can enable from time to time, you know, as the language evolves.
Well, I could go on with you all day, but I want to really thank you very much for taking the time. And this was incredibly helpful and, for me, fascinating, I'm sure, for a lot of people. And hopefully we can have you back on in a week or two. I mean, in a little. In not too long.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you. Whenever you're ready for another one, I am too.
Thanks so much.
Cool.